Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Yogi Busaki, who's Professor of Neuroscience and Neurology at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. His research focuses on brain networks, especially those serving cognitive functions, and the packaging and segmentation of neural information, especially related to sleep. Welcome, Yogi.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thanks for doing this. So you had a short piece on Scientific American, which is really interesting. So it says, constructing the world from inside out, the brain probes your physical surroundings to select just information needed to survive and flourish. So I always wondered about this, Yogi. So I have done some work in artificial intelligence for about 30 years now. And I always wondered there's a cap there, because the way that you're approaching it, in your terminology, I would think it is outside in, right? So it has always been sort of a computational approach to artificial intelligence. But what you're arguing here is the brain doesn't quite work like that, right? So what is the gist of your argument?
You're absolutely right. AI is led by the wrong brain science model. And that recognition has come very slow to me and probably everybody else in the community. But we are coming to an interesting junction in neuroscience where different terms and different mechanisms in the brain confront each other. And then we have to ask serious questions. And one of those serious questions, you know, who are we? And we are our memories, especially our episodes. Our memories define us as individuals. And then you would like to know how to study that episodic memory. And then you got a recipe from somebody who dreamed up a definition, let's say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, that the events that occur to us in space and time. In other words, the episodic memory is what happened to me, where and when. And that's a fantastic simplification, because now you know what you have to look for in the brain. You have to look for what happens, where happens the when, and where happens the where. So there are three axes. And therefore, you don't have to register every single event in your life like in a tape recorder and then search in a linear manner, but you just have to find the where and the what and the when, and then you multiply them, the marginals, and then you got the episode. So this is what happened. People are looking for place cells or place representation, and they found it in the hippocampus, and the Nobel Prizes were given for it. And then you wonder, you know, how it relates to memory, because these neurons also tell the what. This is where the animal is in the environment. And then came along a good friend of mine, Howard Eichenbaum, who said, the cells that are, you can call where cells, are also time cells, that is when cells. And to make the long story short, if you are a computational neuroscientist or a computational scientist, they said, well, wait for a second. Now, let's just break it down into elements. Where is the what, where is the when, and where is the when, where is the where? And the analogy I can give you is that when you are driving your car, only one significant event happens in the car. The piston moves up and down, right? And then you can ask the question, is how far do you live from work? And said, well, 1.7 million strokes from work. That's not a very intelligent piece of conversation. But then you can say, oh, it's 12,035 revolution of the front wheel. That also doesn't get you very far. Or you can say, oh, if I relate these turns to a agreed upon units such as miles and kilometers, then we can communicate, because I can say I live 30 minutes from work, 30 kilometers from work, or 30 miles from work. But then I have also a clock, and then the clock relates to the distance, give it the speed, and then I can tell you how far I am. So I can communicate in multiple ways how far I live from work, but there is only one mechanism. And that's exactly what happens in the hippocampus. There is only one one mechanism, but people who are looking at the time cells or time relationship, they find time. People who are looking at place, they find place. People who are looking for something else, such as the tone change that is significant for the animal, or a color change that you make significant for the animal because it will predict something, then all these neurons are doing one single algorithm. So this was the primary problems, is that we give names and then we are searching for mechanisms in the brain without asking what those names and what those terms actually mean. So yeah. In a larger frame, you can say, you know, brain science didn't ask anything about the brain initially, and we didn't start out wonder about ourselves with the brain. We started out with the spirit. And then we continued with the soul, and then the mind, and then eventually now we are talking about the brain mechanisms, and that's a word that, you know, everybody is using today rather than the spirit. But we wondered what the spirits were for, and where they come from, and where the soul comes from, and where this come from. Is it dependent on the body or not, and so on. So this is the history of our thinking. And in the history of our thinking, they said, oh, the reason why we have the mind or we have the soul is because it was given to us. And it was given to us for one purpose, is to learn the beauty about the world, the beauty of the creator, and so on. So these are the mindsets that imbibed into our brains for centuries or millennia. And then I can take you through the history of philosophy, and you will land somewhere in England, a British empiricist, and they said, oh, all of our experience is coming from the outside world. In other words, the brain is there to sense. The brain is there to combine. The brain is there to associate as a passive device. What the brain does to the body was almost forgotten. And the problem with this philosophy is that, yes, there is a synthetic brain, and then there is an output. But in between what you can call perception and action, there is a big gap. And this is filled in by various terms, such as in your case would be noise in the computational neuroscience, or it could be free will, or it could be decision-making, which is a contemporary term, or you can make you can call it a black box. In other words, there is something that has to be in the middle that is very difficult to research in this framework. And all our terms in current cognitive neuroscience, from memory, decision-making, emotions, whatever you name, are made up and start from folk psychology. And when neuroscience started to poke the brain and investigate the brain, we had this ready-made problem set. And we naively assume that this ready-made problem set has boundaries, and the same boundaries are represented by mechanisms in the brain. This is what I'm questioning.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I learned a lot from just reading the two pieces you sent me, Yorji. So, artificial intelligence is sort of a symptom of this idea. And there are companies like Artificial Mind, all sorts of artificial things. And it's all based on this idea that brain is a computer. It is basically taking information in from outside, processing it, making some sense of it, and then sending instructions back, model. It fits with computational models because it's very easy to program that way. But what you're arguing is that the brain is not like that, right? So, you know, if I had a computer that's sitting around, I would let that computer make make things up and test it and try it. So this goes into sleep also. And so if I understand this correctly, is that what you're arguing is that the brain is creating templates or heuristics or ideas that at some point actually fits with the data that's receiving. And it says, okay, X looks like X prime, so it should be X type conclusion, right? Is that the way you think about it?
Well, something like that. So the inspiration from the brain for AI is that we are looking at our own brains, human brains, and then we try to deduce principles from the human brains without knowing that it took 4 billion years of evolution to get here. So maybe instead of looking at from the complicated problems of the mind, how the mind works, we can see how the mind was created in the first place. So in that review that I send you, we just discovered that a cognitive marker that we and many other laboratories are studying extremely intensely, because it is a mechanism for transferring information from one place to another. It's a mechanism to consolidate memories. It turned out originally it served to serve the body to maintain and adjust glucose levels. So this is the way how evolution works, that something is invented for something, typically serving the body, and then it's reused for something else, such as cognition. Now, this brain that you have, or your brain and my brain, is already calibrated. So yeah. We are trying to replicate that. You are looking at me, you're not moving very much, even though I can see your eye movements and you are nodding and things like that. Just can't help. There's absolutely no need. There is no need to laugh. There is no need to make any grimace. Yet it's so much easier for me to communicate with you because I see your expressions and so on. These are all outputs of the brain. So the main and fundamental property of the brain is to serve the body. The brain has no other function. You know, the liver has function, a separate function. The kidney has a function. The bowels have function that we can well define. The brain doesn't serve anything except coordinate all this activity. And relate all the activity of the body to what the brain, when the brain generates something and adjusts something in the body, it has consequences. And we would like to know the consequences, and the consequences are based secondarily in the outside world. The reason why the brain can be smart is because all living things are embedded into a world where there are recurrences and regularities. And this is what is extracted by living things, especially the brain, is that these regularities can be predictable on the short scale and the long scale. You know, simple environment and the long, the complex environments. So all the complications in the brain are there to make survival effective at a short time scale, or longer and longer and longer time scale, and in a more and more complex environments, eventually including us. Now, AI doesn't have a body.
Yeah. We could give it a body, but exactly. We haven't yet. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to see, and I'm sure it's happening already, that AI combined with robotics is the real thing, because now you have a problem. The problem is how to actuate. And this problem in neuroscience comes with the problem of what's called the brain-machine interfaces, which is a big area of contemporary neuroscience, you know, how you control robot. Here, for the first time, I would say, neuroscientists are confronted with the real question, which is how you move that damn cursor, or how you, now you have to control something. And now there is a reader, which is in this case the cursor. And without a reader, there is no information. You said in your introductory sentence there that we in AI, we read the information from the world. In my world, in my view, there is no information. There's no information in the world. Information is made by the brain. Information becomes information. There are no bits, there's nothing. This is all a definition from a point of view of an observer. And this is what AI can create. They said, okay, this is what I'd like to have and so on. So I said jokingly that AI is mimicking the wrong brain model, and you pointed out yourself, that is the outside in. So let's do an inside out. The problem with that is manifold. The biggest problem is that in order to have a brain like AI, you have to see what the brain's primary function is. And the brain primary function, as I said, is controlling the body, but even more so is maintaining its own dynamic. The brain spends more than half of its energy, half of its spikes, just to maintain its own dynamic in a balanced way. It's only a small fraction is used for what you call information.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big insight for me. So sort of the brain-body connection, I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, you talk about this, I can clearly see why the brain would evolve to a position, its primary mechanism is really making the body work. I mean, it makes sort of logical sense to it, right? So, and then complications happened. Perhaps the brain, the human brain had some excess capacity. It started pondering philosophy and physics and stuff like that. Although it had no connection to the body at that point, right? So are we sort of stepping out of this physical requirement that the brain is fundamentally about controlling the body to some areas that the brain actually had no experience in before?
Yes, so that's an interesting thing that we refer to with a word, I don't have a better word, that we call it disengagement. So when brains become complicated, complex and efficient, and they learn efficiently, at some point, and it's not, you know, one point in evolution, but gradually, they can become independent of the external world. And instead of trying to check certain things such as running away or running towards a predator, now you can contemplate without actually acting out. But that can happen only after the brain has been calibrated already. So Here is an example, you know, different vocabularies, but the hippocampus, which is my favorite structure, has been advertised for doing various things. Now, traditionally, we are looking for boxes in the brain where the certain conceived ideas are present. And what you know, what you knew 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is that the hippocampus is about memories. They are serving memories. But not so long ago, you learned it in New York Times that it's the GPS of the brain. It's a spatial navigation device. So what is the connection between spatial navigation and episodic memory? Now, it's a little bit not so complicated, but just imagine that nature created a mechanism that allows the animals to move around effectively in the world. We call it spatial navigation. But at some point, the same algorithm can be exploited to do fictive navigation, which is traveling mentally into our past or into our future. And now we call them memory or planning or imagination. But over the past 10 years, converging evidence from humans to animals shows that the same algorithms are used for all of these. And then you sit back and said, wait a second, you know, how can I plan without memory? There is no future without the past, and so on. And so you will realize that all these words are discrete, but in their brain mechanisms, they are either overlapping or identical. And that's a different kind of approach, because then you can say, what is a thought? Thought is an output of the brain. And where is the thought generated? We don't know. Usually we say, Now the frontal area, so this part of the brain from here to here, is, you can call it the frontal, it's mostly the action part. And from here to here is the, you can call it sensory part, you know, by very strong simplification. Now, the interesting thing is that the motor cortex, which is the output for the motor actions, but in the prefrontal cortex has pretty much the same input outputs. They are connected to very similar structures. Now, my outputs, and this is what the consequences of the action is not only movement, the action is heart rate change, respiration change, endocrine change, anything that the brain sends out as a message to the body could be conceived as an action. The thought is also an action, because it's come from the action system that comes from the anterior part of the brain, except its consequences on the body itself are delayed. The action is only useful when it has some consequences and beneficial consequences for the body. And thoughts are only as useful as their consequences in the future, but you have to act it out. You know, unless you can communicate and verify your actions, including the thoughts, they are useless. And so the thought is a, just like what I mentioned to you about the disengagement of navigation becomes memory or mental travel, physical travel, mental travel. The disengagement from action is the thought. And it seems like a radically different, crazy idea. But if you look at the mechanisms in the brain and you look at how it evolved, then it makes a hell lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is so interesting. So disengagement from action is thought, as you say. Einstein has said that most of his ideas came to him in his sleep. And really interesting thoughts, creative ones, are not really related to physical actions, right? It's almost like you're disconnecting, as you say, from the real world and sort of moving around to try to find something more interesting.
So sleep is the honest state of the brain.
Yeah.
I can read out from your brain during your sleep more than interviewing you. The reason is that because you can mislead me, you can lie. I know you are not doing it, but in principle you can. I can ask you questions, but you are not interested in those questions. You are not answering them. I can make you do a reaction time experiment and you will be pretty lousy because you're not interested, but with another investigator you will be. But during your sleep, your brain dynamic is, it shows you who you are. Now, the brain, we discovered a pattern many years ago. We call it sharp wave ripples or sharp waves in the hippocampus. These are very short, about 100 millisecond, very synchronous patterns, the most synchronous pattern in the mammalian brain. It looks like a mini epilepsy, but it's physiological. Yeah. And its entire goal is to compress the information in time, if you want, what happens to us during sleep, and fragment that information. So the conversation that we are having now will be replayed 4,000 times tonight in funny little segments. And the most of the things that will be replayed are the recent learned information, today's. And then it will be mixed and turned. And so it mixed like in a child's mind, you know, there's a lot of mixture going on. So that many, many associations, subconscious associations occur during sleep, most of which bizarre and don't make sense and so on. But some of them are there. So you mentioned Einstein. Einstein was actually not the most famous. The most famous was Kekulé, benzene, and then there is a reliable story also from Otto Loewi, who discovered sympatin. There are many, many creative people who said sleep is very long. Edison, for example, is famous about his sleep patterns, that he knew that his great ideas come at this subliminal phase before he falls asleep. And you and I have Nobel Prize winning experiments every night, except that by the time we wake up, they are gone. So what he did is that he had ball bearings in his hands. In his armchair, he was sleeping in his armchair, and then when he really dozed off, then he lost his muscle control, then the ball bearings fell on the floor and he woke up himself. So he maintained himself in this subliminal zone where he thought was dreaming. Now this is the time when there are so many sharp wave ripples, so these are the mixtures of the old and the new, and the brain prioritizes according to its own internal interest rather than our intentional thoughts. So when I go to a talk, I like to listen to every single remember every one of them. I can't, though a little bit I can, but most of it is my brain oscillations that go on, and the meandering attention and the meandering computation that determines what is taken in and what is rejected. In fact, we just have a nice paper coming out next month about this, how the brain can select something that has to be retained and something that has to be swept into the trash can.
Yeah, I look forward to it. So what is sort of the evolutionary basis of this? So, you know, if I have a very simple objective function, which is basically food and sex to basically, you know, get my genes out there. What is the value of all this complexity? I mean, are humans an error to the biological evolution process?
You can take a extraordinary wild view and think like a physicist, and you say, well, what's the difference between AI and human brain? What's the difference between the organic world and inorganic world? And there's a good answer. The inorganic world is controlled by the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy increases. The only exception to this are living systems. Entropy is increasing. The level of organization is there. Now, you can take this wide view and said, well, there is another word which, again, you and I hate, let's say goal. And this is something that is a funny word, because goals are tricky. You know, I can explain you what goals, and every human knows that there are goals. But if you look at evolution, it's so easy, simple to explain everything with a goal. But this is the tricky part, is that if the goal is there is no goal in evolution, there are behind alleys, but in retrospect,
it's exposed.
It looks like there was a goal, which is the creation of the human brain. So the difference between creationism and science is subtle, but it's extraordinarily importantly subtle. You know, one is looking at the something is pulling me or something is pushing me. And this is the same subtle but important difference between the outside in and the inside out view. Because many of my colleagues, I said, what difference does it make? It does make a difference in when you design an experiment, and especially when you interpret them. So this is the key issue. And you know, AI is created by humans. So but AI doesn't have goals. We do have goals. At least looks like we have goals. Animals, all animals have, even any living creature, you would say, it has a goal. It has a goal is to survive. even though it's not a goal, but that's that kind of program is there, which is what makes living systems so different from non-living. And if you take it that way, then now we can play with the contrast between AI and the human brain.
Yeah, so in the mid-80s, my graduate thesis was a certain AI program. Well, we used to call it expert systems for education in engineering. And so reading your paper, I was thinking we were actually quite advanced in the sense that, what we did was to sort of prime the computer with a set of templates, because we could actually take the graduate students and put them into a dozen buckets. And we could say, how those buckets are going to going to interact with the computer. This was a sort of optimization problem, which is, how do you get to the minimum cost design in engineering problem? And so, when I was reading your paper, I was thinking, yeah, so this is sort of a template problem in the sense that, so the brain is there, it's sleeping, it's a lot of the time it's just idle, it's just thinking about stuff, it's creating templates. Most of them may not be that useful, but at some point it's going to find template X32 looks like this thing. So I'm just going to store it with higher value, right? Is that the process?
So that's very good that you contrast your experience in the 80s with today's backpropagation models, is because we all admire what's happening in AI, of course. This is tremendous progress. But when it comes to the dialogue between neuroscience or the brain, and I have people who, most people from my lab go to AI. I can't help it, but that's fine. But then they take the knowledge with them that there is another way of doing artificial system, which is more brain-like. Now, it is probably more complicated, but probably more efficient. As you said, they come with a template. So this is what we call pre-configuration. So even the newborn brain comes in enormous, enormous amount of pre-configured capacity. And that system doesn't change very much in terms of dynamics. So if I take a brain that was raised in an artificial condition and never learned anything, never seen anything, and then I do an EEG measurement or fMRI measurement, I will find a difference between that brain and another brain, but it will be minuscule compared to the contrasting similarity.
Yeah.
So it's enormously similar. The brain dynamics are reflected in time by brain oscillations. We've got about 10, 15 different type of oscillations, different frequency bands, and they serve different functions and so on. They are the same frequencies, the same duration, the same everything in every mammalian brain, every one of them, even though the brain size from the smallest to the largest mammal is about 17,000 fold. So this scaling respects one thing, which is timing. And that timing is related to the, not to the microsecond world, but to the slow world of the body. There is no point making my computer up here super fast, because my muscle cannot contract faster than tens of milliseconds, 100 milliseconds. And this myosin, actin myosin relationship is the same in all animals, all mammals, at least at the body temperature. So there is this goal, if you want, the output that has to be controlled. The brain is a control device, and everything is subserving that control. Now, the current AI is doing something funny and very interesting, is the doing some tuning things. It looks like this is evolution. So the current AI starts out from scratch, de novo, and then it has a goal. It's like intelligent design, that it has a goal, but the goal is given not by God, by a human, and said, do whatever you want to get the goal. But that's more like evolution. It's recreating evolution. And with a lot of problems, including catastrophic interference and so on, which is like the dead ends or blind alleys of evolution. So it said, okay, this system is good enough, but it failed here. Okay, let's try another one, another one, another one, another one, another one. The other option is that, okay, if you would like to do a brain-like and moving towards human level, then say, okay, now we have to create a AI that has all these, what you call templates, the pre-configured things, and let's add a body. Or let's if it's not a body, at least an actuator, and say it has to get, it has to have a purpose, and things may be different.
I was thinking, you know, there's sort of an operating system question. So when a baby is born, he or she is given an operating system. And I think you talk about this in this or somewhere else that, you know, the baby knows how to cry when he or she is hungry. So it's sort of an innate operating system function. It'll be very interesting to look at longitudinally to say, you know, 100 years from now, will we have a baby that comes out with an operating system function, how to use the iPhone? I mean, we could, right? I'm thinking evolutionarily.
Say it again, what the problem is.
Yeah, so, you know, right now it's basic functions like crying when you're hungry type stuff. Yes. But 100, maybe 500 years from now, will we have babies, you know, at 1 month, who knows how to use an iPhone? You know, I mean, we are feeding information back into the system in some way, right? Aren't we?
So this is where the blind alleys and evolution and selection should work. So my answer to this is the opposite, that a baby that was born 10,000 years ago, 10,000 years is nothing.
Yeah.
But in human evolution, in terms of what we know back then, you know, you have this warm coffee here that's made by a machine to you. I mean, just preparing that, and you had to spend more than 50% of your daily activity just to hunt, to get or collect food. So now let's do a Gedanke experiment that we adopt a baby that was born 10,000 years ago and give away one of our babies born today and travel back in time and give it to a hunter-gatherer society.
Yeah.
The question is whether that baby who was imported to the 21st century will have a chance to attend NYU. And my answer is absolutely. It has the same chance because brain dynamic hasn't changed at all. And the knowledge base of that person, somebody who lives in the Amazon. Just imagine Albert Einstein was born in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Who knows? He was.
He would have come up with a better theory.
I'm just kidding. An abstract thinker is not a very effective machine in the jungle. So that's the interesting part, is that the brain evolution, the brains are not moving. They are not much better. Your brain is not better than the brain of any person in anywhere in the world with the same. Of course, their brains are very different. They have distributions. There are extraordinarily smart people and so on, all of these things. But it doesn't matter which culture you live in, whether it was 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, or today.
Because the time scales. Yeah, I mean, the time scales we can think about is so short, we don't expect any changes in those time scales because we need, if I understand you correctly, we need hundreds of thousands or millions of years of changes for that operating system to change. But at some point, your operating system could change, right? So if you have a higher survival benefit, with a few apps that that the babies are not born today with, those apps would be installed.
Yeah, definitely, that has to be a change. You know, when I lived in a communist system, and when I learned biology about natural selection, I wondered, you know, how there will be in 100 years a new generation of babies who will be thinking in communism. And of course, that is a very short timescale. To have anything, you need several generations. A nice experiment that has been done in Siberia with Arctic foxes. So yeah. We did it with rodents. We wanted to have tame rodents. We didn't want to have the experimental animals bite off our fingers. And so these tame foxes, they bred foxes. This is, I think it's now 50 years, 50 some generations. And interestingly, the tameness changes and co-segregates with a lot of things, including color of the fur. There are so many different things that go together. And then we know it from the Ashkenazi Jews and so on, that their creativity comes with a cost. There are many diseases that highly creative individuals have, certain types of diseases like kidney, and it's totally unrelated, or joint problems and so on, or bowel problems. It's a funny thing. In my book, which is, by the way, the extension of the Scientific American article, I have in every chapter, when I mention some scientists from any walks of life, I try to figure out whether that creative person had a family history of mental disease. And my own little research coincides very nicely with what we know, is that if you are a super creative individual, somebody in your family pays for it, because then you have a brother or sister or grandfather or somebody who has mental disease. And so the variation is enormous. Evolution always plays with fire because it makes things worse. But while making things worse, it gets to the maximum of the possibilities. And for certain aberrations of the mind are perfect for one environment. So the super level of abstraction could be very, very good for a theoretical physicist. But it comes maybe with other features. You know, many scientists are known to be autistic and so on.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So this, in some sense, is inside-out process. If you find errors in it in some ways, I want to call it errors, but, you know, whatever, creativity could be an error in some ways because it's somewhat suboptimum from a system perspective. You're saying two things, I think, if I understand you correctly. One is there is sort of a genetic history to it, that when you say somebody else is paying for it, means that there's sort of a genetic issue in some ways, right?
Yes. But that's what you asked. Now, what happens, you know, with do you have a baby who will drink coffee right away? So if it probably takes, I said 10,000 years is nothing, because the reason why I used about this time scale is because this is where the human mankind catapulted into current situation, that we created the first abstract thought. When was the time when the brain created the first abstract thought? Now, this is a interesting question, but can be probably tracked back to the, just a second.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Take care. Thank you. Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
So, the Sumerian wedge writings show this very nicely. You know, one of the first concrete abstract thought would be numbers. You know, how numbers were invented, and you can see that. I like it because it shows the beauty of actions. That first you started counting, and then you invented some things. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I got 5 figures. Or if you were biased by some religious ideas, then you said, okay, 12 is the magic number, or 12 and 60. Then you figure out something, how to do that. But in the early Sumerian writings, there was a concreteness of the numbers. Every single number referred to a particular object, such as the sheet or bushels or something. And with the concentration of the minds in big cities, then it may have happened that the person who was counting sheep was hired by somebody else and had to count something different, and all of a sudden realized that now you can disengage from the substrate because five is the same, whether you are counting sheep or bushels, doesn't matter. And so that kind of action-based feedback can generate a thought, but then that's a skill that you can give verbally to another individual. Now, the humans have a very interesting track, a trick, which is language. You know, yeah. This is called externalization. We talked about internalization. That is externalization of brain function, which is creating something and leaving a message. If I create something and I leave it in the Sahara Desert, any human being 10,000 years from now will look at it and immediately recognizes that this is man-made. If you're walking anywhere, you can distinguish between man-made objects and naturally occurring objects. Or rocks or whatever. So it's a message that survives you 10,000 years, 100,000 years, and so on. And it can give information to many people. And then this sign of communication, externalization of the brain, of course, is what happened with books. And now we have the agora of our thinking, which is the internet. So it creates the sense, the illusion that we are smarter. Yes, we are absolutely smarter as a humankind, but my share of this knowledge is minuscule. So if I look at the relative knowledge of a human being today, it is pretty limited. You know, just think about how much individuals knew relative to humankind knowledge 100,000 years ago, or how much a dog knows about what other dogs know. Dogs know. Every dog's share of the dog's kind knowledge is large, but my knowledge is getting smaller and smaller and smaller every day. And if in absolute terms it's larger, it's due to the trick that humans have, which is communication. And semantic knowledge could be, you know, I have a funnel here, and you pour in knowledge into my brain on a daily basis because I take you as a superior agent. You are my parent or guidance or leader, and I accept everything you say without asking. You know, I know this is a screw here. I know this is we can use abbreviations in iPhone and so on. I don't even know what it means. I just know its utility. And yeah. I never ask the origin of the meaning because it was never defined. But everybody knows what GPS. 99% of the people, they don't know what it stands for or how it came about because it's irrelevant in most cases. So this is how with human communication, we can create the illusion that because our knowledge is larger, that our hardware is developing also. The hardware doesn't have to develop. It just has to be exploited more efficiently because I am who I am because of you. You know, I alone with my own brain, I don't even know what kind of consciousness I would have. I don't know what it means I am unless I see myself in the eyes of others. So this is where the interesting problem of the mind and brain comes up. So how do I know and segregate myself from everything else? Is this emerging species knowledge that is different from the individual mind's knowledge?
So I want to finish up. I know that you have to get on a flight soon. So I want to finish up this sort of mind body problem with life sciences issues. So you talk about some of the things in your paper. I can't quite remember. So diabetes, for instance. So you know, sort of the control of blood sugar is essentially done by the brain, if I understand this correctly. And if so, we could be able to create some interventions that are not physical, but brain-based, right? Is that possible?
So the idea about the brain-body problem comes into two flavors. One is that what I said about the evolutionary thinking and the figuring out how the brain works. But the other one is more practical, is that what does the body buy for the brain? And one example you mentioned is that, or I already mentioned, is that that a pattern that we are obsessed about as a physiological pattern, it turns out that that same pattern occurs also in a lizard, which doesn't have a very complicated cortex, so there's not much to read out. But the that pattern also signals downstream something to the hypothalamus and perhaps to the vagal nerve, and then the communication with the body is very clear. So indeed, the body can have its own, it's known homeostatic functions, but the homeostatic functions are even more useful if they become allostatic, which means they are predictable. You prepare your body with a little bit of more glucose tolerance because you are going to have a good meal. And so that kind of preparation, or some people can tell the brain to wake up at 6 o'clock tomorrow without an alarm clock. So this is a miraculous thing, how the brain can be programmed to predict the future in such a precision and several hours earlier. So the brain is superimposed on a simpler homeostatic mechanism that is in the body. And whenever something goes bad in the brain, that's reflected in the body. Vice versa, if something goes in the body, you will recognize it. No. Emotion, this is another interesting thing that AI doesn't have. you have a blue shirt, and you have a shirt on your body. You don't notice it, but now that I'm mentioning, you know that you have a shirt on you because you feel it. Most of these things are totally ignored, and they are not there. But I tell you some bad news. All of a sudden, your heart rate goes up. The heart rate is not noticed. Your breathing pattern is not noticed. But the moment you notice, there is something wrong. Something wrong with my body, my own body, and that interferes with your thinking. The problem with pain and everything is that you cannot really function well because there is a competition between what you are trying to use little amount of computation that is called available computation is called working memory, that all of a sudden something protrudes in it, the pain, and then it takes away from your capacity to think clearly and so on. So this is where the body and the brain are really interacting in both directions.
Yeah, so what's your view? So can we treat type 2 diabetes, hypertension, things like that through the brain? I don't think we have tried this yet. We have chemical interventions, mostly chemical interventions right now, but could we have brain-based, magnetic, some other ways to cure these diseases?
So I hear the resistance from many of my internist friends who said, oh, when you have a very high cholesterol, then the brain doesn't help. It's true. But the brain can help with a lot of times when your high blood pressure increases because of your emotions. And those are challenges. And those challenges can be indeed affected. Now, you talked about the drugs. The drugs have a huge problem. The huge problem is that you take it and it's constant. And so it has side effects, and it has the side effects constantly. You cannot make a drug that doesn't have a side effect. So what we would need is something that is, let's say, in a good example in drugs, that you have a headache or you have a migraine and you take a drug on demand. And so that on demand thing sometimes would be interfering with your brain activity when you have seizures or when you have interictal epileptic discharge. You just say, just adjust my brain now for the next 2 seconds or 1 second even, but do it 100 times a day or 1,000 times a day. This is where pharmaceuticals don't help, but electrocuticles or magnetocuticles, they may. So this is a big industry today, how to do closed loop interactions with the brain to affect and improve brain patterns and brain functions. And this is what we have done several times in the lab in rodents, that we can erase all learned information by erasing sharpies from your brain. So if you allow me to take out all the sharpies in your brain tonight, you will not remember anything what we have discussed today. We had a paper in Science 2 years ago where we showed that we can do the other reaction, which is more difficult. We are very good in screwing up the brain. We are not very good in improving it. But this experiment, we showed that the sharpie ripples, we made about 30% longer and the performance of the animals increased. So indeed, there are ways to do things differently than it used to be. And I don't want to mention Elon Musk and, you know, the industry out there. This is the goal.
Yeah, so I have some exposure to the pharmaceutical industry, but I always been interested in this, what you call magnetoceuticals and electroceuticals. So how do you want to phrase it? Because the body is an electromagnetic chemical system. And we and have
the brain, been it's an electrical system.
So I mean, we got the chemicals are easier. So we just say, you know, put X into the body and you measure Y, and you know, things seem to be 51% better compared to 49%. That's fundamentally what pharmaceutical industry is all about. But they are not cures typically. They are just symptomatic treatments to ailments. But we could have actually cures from the other direction, right? Magnetic and electric.
So I have offshoots from my lab. I had a postdoc who was working with me. We published a paper in Science showed how to prevent epileptic seizures with closed loop stimulation in an animal. And then he went back home. He created his company doing it in humans and so on. And he sold his company for a lot of money to BlackRock. And so they are on the market now. They are doing closed loop stimulation in humans. BlackRock will do it soon. And I assume other companies also, because one thing, it's very difficult to become immune to electricity for an electrical organ like the brain. But the brain becomes resistant to drugs, and in the temporal lobe seizures, more than 50% of the cases become drug resistant to every known epileptic drug. And the current solution is take out a big piece of tissue from the brain, or no solution. So, you know, new avenues and new attempts are really welcome. And it seems that epilepsy is a good start, because it's about electrical problems, and that can be dealt with the electrical interventions.
How about cancer? We are increasingly seeing brain cancer in humans. Do you see applications there?
I'm not an expert at all on cancers, and the cancers are probably have much more common across the body, whether they are in the brain or not, you know, discounting gliomas and neuronomas and so on. But the mechanisms are pretty much the same. But they are using, interestingly, similar things that can be localized. You know, one of the things you are dreaming about is that you don't want to open the skull, so you can deliver a substance through your body. Let's say you have a brain tumor, and then somehow activate the tumor part of your brain from outside, such as with radio frequency field that one of my postdocs is doing. And then there, and only there, release a ligand that will be temperature sensitive. And then the same radio frequency later on can be used therapeutically to kill the tumor, to kill those cells that were activated locally. So this is a far-fetched dream at the moment, but there are many attempts, and things like that are being done in tumor surgeries, that they deliver drugs or they deliver substances to the cells that can they mark and manipulate them selectively. Thinking differently is the essence of science.
I really like this idea. I mean, I didn't know anything about it before I read your papers, you know, sort of the mind, the brain-body connection. the fundamental idea, you know, the brain is learning from the body's requirements, motions, expectations, and it creates templates based on that, and it uses the templates to understand the environment, and consciousness and cognition sort of emerge from that complication, if I understand this correctly. And so, as you say, an artificial intelligent agent without a body is going to have a tough time figuring out stuff. That's the way I understand it now.
Good.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for spending time with me. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Good talking to you. Take care.